your left-handedness kind of feeds into how you see yourself as a musician?
Not just as a musician, but just I think left-handed people generally, I mean, I don't know if it's a fact, but we seem to have a better spatial awareness. A lot of left-handed people make good architects, for example. And with the piano, I naturally want to think of the high notes on the left mentally. It's not just the physical thing. I remember listening to Ashkenazi once in a concert, and he was playing a piece of music of some Schumann, Kreisleriana, and I'd only played it on a normal right-handed piano in the past. But as I was listening to music with my eyes closed, and I suddenly found myself, I was playing it left-handed mode without even ever having tried it. So I do like to think in the opposite direction. And also with numbers in space, I see numbers in different places in space. I mean, I just like to have a different palette, my visual palette of the world, really.
It's interesting that although he's a musician, Christopher Seed sees his left-handedness in a visual sense. The symbolism of left and right is well established in the history of painting, with the right representing what is good and strong, and the left somehow seen as not only weak, but morally suspect.
Artists use left and right in pictures in different ways. It's not clear whether that's actually related to handedness as such, or more to the fact that we write from left to right. And I think there are many asymmetries in the world we live in, and it looks like all of that is more related to the direction of writing. So, for instance, photographs tend to have the tallest one on the left and the smallest one on the right, but you go to Iran and look at the photographs of rows of children, and they're the other way round. Studies of the handedness of great painters don't show any significant difference that I can see. So I'm not sure that one is there, but there's a meaning to right and left, which is another matter, and everybody perceives those meanings.
And throughout history, for left-handers, those meanings are generally negative. The Latin for left is sinistra. In the Anglican Creed, Christ sits on the right hand of the Father, and in many Islamic cultures, it would be considered shockingly discourteous to consume food with your left hand. Why should the actions of the left hand so universally have been interpreted as strange?
I agree, it seems baffling. I think actually it's simply the fact that people spot when people are different.
Ziggy played for time, jiving us that we were voodoo. The kids were just crass.
And I think if anything was different about us, then that can get used to discriminate. And I think one of the most interesting things is, you know, why people with blue eyes aren't discriminated against. That one, you'd almost expect them to be discriminated against because they look different to most people. But most things where there's difference, you know, even being blonde, you know, it's assumed somehow that reflects other characteristics about people and so on. And so I think people are very good at that. And we're naturally a very intolerant species. We're very concerned about sticking with the in-group and being different from out-groups and distinguishing them. And therefore, I think handedness might well have been something that was used. The other thing here is that symbolism gets attached to everything. Male, female, up, down, right, left. You know, it doesn't matter what you look at. And so it will get tied in with good, bad in the end, because that's the big symbolism we use with everything. So if one's going to be good and one's going to be bad, you can guess which one it is. The majority one becomes good, or the more powerful becomes good, and the weaker or the less common becomes bad. And that's the right-handers and women as well.
And I've got the double whammy then, haven't I?
Yes.
To what extent do you think those sorts of prejudices still exist today? Or do you think now we're just so open and tolerant that actually people are unaware of it?
I think we're not very tolerant of left-handers, interestingly. I mean, sometimes, only half-jokingly, I say they're the last great neglected minority who have nobody to defend their rights, as it were. You know, every other group is, we care about them. If somebody says, let's have National Left-Handers Day and let's try and make it so that equipment and tools and machinery or anything else is equally good for right and left-handers, everybody rolls around laughing and then says, let's get on with the next problem. And so it's not treated seriously in some way. And you know, you go out and try and buy equipment for left-handers. Try and buy a digital camera where you push the button with your left hand rather than your right. I defy you to find one. And, you know, that's interesting. It doesn't matter much. But if you're flying jet aircraft or if you're driving complex machines or anything, then potentially it is a problem. And we can design these things so that left-handers work. You know, if you think about the ordinary kettle in the kitchen, they always used to have a thing to see so you could see how much water was in them, and you'd held it in your right hand. Now they've redesigned them, and you can see from either side. So it can be done, and now that's normal.
Is there a part of you that's slightly evangelical about the idea of left-handedness and a left-handed piano? Because, of course, there are some people who view being left-handed as a disability, or get very cross with a kind of a right-handed world and a sort of right-handist attitude. Is there a part of that in you, a part of you that's a bit chippy about it?
A little bit. I'm not as evangelical as perhaps I ought to be. But I got angry once with the bank. They'd spent I don't know how many thousands of pounds on putting in new booths, beautiful glass frontage, with a pen stuck in stone on the right with a chain. So when I was writing a cheque, you know, you're writing across the chequebook and you get in the way. So I actually asked to speak to the manager and got them to put in some pens on the other side as well. So that's probably about the limit of my sort of evangelical sort of approach. With a piano, in a way, I almost want to get away from the fact it's left-handed. It's so unnatural. I don't want actually to think about it. It's not something I actually just love to play the piano, this particular piano. So I don't want to have to keep referring to the fact it's left-handed. It's just a natural way of playing for me. And that's why I had it made. And that's why it sort of speaks to me like that.
Ultimately, what Christopher Seed seems to have discovered is approaching his piano playing in a left-handed way has brought as many rewards as it has drawbacks. Here's the late and much-missed writer on music, Robert Sandel.
When Jimi Hendrix came along, the whole thing went crazy again, because Hendrix, very interestingly, was a left-handed player who used to play right-handed guitars, which meant that the first thing that he saw, the first thing he came to when he was playing the guitar, were all the electronic controls. He really was using the guitar as an electronic sound source first and as a stringed instrument second, and he created the most extraordinary panoply of guitar effects as a result of that.
When it comes to creativity, it seems self-evident that overcoming any difficulty offers the opportunity to discover new ways of approaching art, new ways of doing, and new ways of perceiving. I know that in my own case, being left-handed feels intimately connected with the way in which, as a writer, I feel I often look at people around me sideways, slightly differently. We all have our own personal mythologies that we use instinctively to explain ourselves to ourselves, and left-handedness is just another one of those, which 1 in 10 of the population is lucky enough to have access to. We're different, but like Ziggy Stardust, we're special.
He Played It Left Hand was presented by the left-handed novelist and piano player Louise Doty. It's produced by another Southpaw, Julian May. Well, welcome back to the Royal Albert Hall. You're listening live on BBC Radio 3. I'm Sarah Moore-Peach, and we're also hearing this evening from tonight's conductor, Esa-Pekka Salonen, about the programme here at the Proms. Well, A Left Hand is about to take centre stage here at the Hall, the Left Hand Piano Concerto by Ravel, which he wrote for Paul Wittgenstein, the brother of Ludwig Wittgenstein, the philosopher. Now, Paul Wittgenstein lost his right arm in the First World War, and he used his wealth to commission works from various composers, all the way from Strauss to Britten. Wittgenstein actually wasn't always pleased with the pieces that he received from these commissions. He was quite ambitious, and he often wanted composers to change their work to suit him, which led him and Ravel to having a spat about whether the composer or the performer should be the slave. But at any rate, the left-handed piano concerto proved hugely popular. So here's tonight's conductor, Esa-Pekka Salonen, about the piece.
Well, this piece is a miracle in every way, completely apart from the fact that the technical achievement is unbelievable. It's a deeply touching piece of music, and it goes to a place where Ravel rarely goes to. It's a sort of a darker place and almost violent, and the sort of childlike music box kind of music that Ravel was so fond of at this point in his output, there's very little of it. There's a sort of a Chinese-sounding phrase here and there, but then he comes back to this very sort of serious and poetical expression. I find it absolutely fascinating. And of course, the very fact that all this is being done with one hand is unbelievable. And somehow, I think that the physical struggle, the sort of the way sometimes blind people develop an incredibly acute hearing, I think also that the one hand having to do all that kind of develops a sort of an expression, an energy, which is kind of beyond anything that could be done with two hands. Somehow, it's just the perfect score in every way. I quite often, when I speak with young composers, for instance, about orchestral balance and perfection of using registers, how to disperse chords into space, this is such a textbook, brilliant Bible of orchestration.
The Finnish conductor Esa-Pekka Salonen, who's conducting the Philharmonia Orchestra tonight at the Proms, talking about the left-handed piano concerto by Ravel, which we're about to hear, played by the pianist Jean-Efflant Beauvoisier. And if you go online right now, you can download the programme notes and read an interview with the pianist Beauvoisier, in which he says that when he was younger, he found Ravel's music was the best remedy for depression. When I felt my connection to music generally waning, I would play Ravel and he would restore my enthusiasm. Well, let's see if it works for us too. Jean-Efflant Beauvoisier making his way onto the stage of the Royal Albert Hall with the conductor Esa-Pekka Salonen for Ravel's piano concerto for the left hand.
Thank you. the French pianist Jean-Eflon Bavouzet, playing live here at the Royal Albert Hall, the left-hand piano concerto by Maurice Ravel, alongside the Philharmonia Orchestra and their chief conductor, Esa-Pekka Salonen. Piece of music which Ravel wrote for Paul Wittgenstein, the Austrian pianist who lost his right arm in the First World War. Jean-Eflon Bavouzet says that he reads aspects of this concerto as Ravel's response to the First World War, those repeated rhythms of a marching army. Must be quite a strange experience for a pianist who does have both arms in working order to perform that piece. What's interesting watching from behind is that he doesn't just sit at the piano as he normally would. He actually has to turn and move around so that his left hand can reach right from the bottom of the keyboard all the way to the top where the right hand would normally be playing. And he is a very physical performer, Jean-Eflon Bavouzet. I saw him sort of thrust his left arm out towards the orchestra whenever he took a line of music and threw it to the orchestra to take up, as it were. Jean-Eflon Bavouzet returning to the stage with conductor Esa-Pekka Salonen, who's bringing individual members of the wind section to their feet. And the brass, and now the whole orchestra. Well, another thing that Jean-Eflon Bavouzet says in the programme notes is how extraordinary it is that Ravel is the one 20th century composer of piano music who was himself a very bad pianist. Well, the composer of the final work in tonight's concert was actually a very good pianist. He studied at the Moscow Conservatoire, where he came second only to Rachmaninoff in his year. And he started his professional life as a concert performer. The Russian composer Alexander Scriabin is a fascinating figure. He was mollycoddled by the women in his life after his mother had died. He was a follower of Madame Blavatsky's theosophy, and he became increasingly self-obsessed throughout his life, out to redeem the world with his music. Well, tonight's concert closes with Scriabin's mystical poem of ecstasy. Now, to start the programme, we heard Esa-Pekka Salonen talking about the cross-currents in the music tonight. So, in his opinion, what's the link between Ravel and Scriabin?
Of course, between Ravel and Scriabin, there's this sort of end-of-an-era kind of feel. I mean, they were of different decades and all that, but they were all both deeply affected by the First World War, and both, in a sense, in their late production, mark an end of a certain idea and style of writing music.
Well, Scriabin wrote his poem of ecstasy over 3 years, between 1905 and 1908. And at the very beginning of that time, he went abroad and he came across the famous Madame Blavatsky and her theosophical teachings, the strand of esoteric mysticism, which was all the rage in Europe. She's the one who's immortalised by T.S. Eliot as Madame Sesostris in his poem The Wasteland. Madame Sesostris, famous clairvoyant, had a bad cold. Nevertheless, is known to be the wisest woman in Europe with a wicked pack of cards. Well, Scriabin was definitely inspired. He wrote a text shortly afterwards which he called The Poem of Ecstasy, and it was the basis of the music which we're going to hear next.
It's like a very, very, very rich dessert that you can have it once every now and then, but you can't have it all the time because it would kill you. And of course, this is a piece where we collectively say goodbye to all kinds of things like good taste, proper musical behavior, all that, and it just pulls all the stops. And I'm especially pleased to be able to do it in this hall, because the organ has got this unbelievable pipe, 64 foot low C, which is something that you can't really hear, but you can feel how your kidneys shake when it plays. Everything is of bad taste in this piece, and it's a tremendous fun to do. As a kid, I went to a concert in Helsinki conducted by Yevgeny Svetlanov, the great Russian conductor. He was not entirely sober that night. And he conducted this piece with his orchestra, and he decided to create even more crescendo at the end by kneeling down and then getting up gradually, and that was meant to create a crescendo. And then, of course, he wasn't completely sober, so he had great trouble getting up, and he was sort of hovering, and then finally he grabbed the music stand and kind of pulled himself up. And the crescendo that came out of the orchestra was the loudest sound I've ever heard in my life, still, I think. And I must have been 11 or 12 or something like that. And I remember there was a lady next to me who, out of sheer excitement and panic seeing Svetlanov struggling with the stand, grabbed my hand, and then, you know, when the piece was over, of course, realized that she had grabbed my hand, and she was very, very embarrassed. And this is a memory for life. I told this story to the orchestra yesterday, and today I was kind of making a sort of vague imitation of that movement, but it was incredibly effective.
Are you going to do it tonight?
I don't know. The one thing I do know, and I'm going to conduct this concert sober.
Tonight's conductor, Esa-Pekka Salonen. Well, after the performance of Scriabin's Poem of Ecstasy, I'll let you know how he conducted the final moments of it. The Philharmonia Orchestra, of which Esa-Pekka Salonen is chief conductor, is on stage now, ready and tuned. Their leader tonight is Zsoltihamer Vizontai. In a funny sort of way, Scriabin shares something with Arvo Pärt, whose fourth symphony we heard earlier on. In terms of their artistic preoccupations, both of them concerned with spirituality and mysticism. And the way in which they achieve this is also kind of similar. They've invented their own harmonic languages. Arvo Pärt, his tintinnabuli sound, and Scriabin, a carefully constructed series of chords and harmonies that meant he can modulate almost any key, and it lends his music an otherworldly quality. Well, a bit of a false alarm there. Esa-Pekka Salonen looked as though he might be coming out onto the stage of the Royal Albert Hall, but no appearance. Who knows, perhaps he was having a swift drink. Well, here he comes now, Esa-Pekka Salonen, to conduct the Philharmonia Orchestra in Scriabin's Poem of Ecstasy.
Thank you. Thank you.
quite a crescendo, and achieved by tonight's conductor, Esa-Pekka Salonen, entirely standing. We heard him earlier remembering seeing Svetlanov with a rather different technique, crouching and then rising to his feet for the final moments. But Esa-Pekka Salonen, as he said, completely sober tonight, managing it, standing throughout. But what a crescendo it was he achieved with his orchestra, the Philharmonia Orchestra. That was Scriabin's Poem of Ecstasy, an extraordinary work written in the early years of the 20th century. And you just heard it performed live here at the Royal Albert Hall at the BBC Proms. That piece of music is sometimes called Scriabin's Fourth Symphony. And if you enjoyed that, then tune in on Tuesday next week in the evening to another prom in which you can hear Scriabin's Symphony No. 3, known as the Divine Poem. Esa-Pekka Salonen has just brought all of the brass of the Philharmonia Orchestra to their feet. And the leader of the orchestra tonight, Zsolt Suhamer Vizsontai, also on his feet, and everyone else, the strings and woodwind as well. And percussion at the back, an extraordinary array of percussion in that work. And tubular bells making a return appearance. Of course, there were tubular bells in the Arvo Pärt Four Symphony, which we had the UK premiere of just earlier on this evening. Well, some of the music that we've heard tonight has been pretty experimental, not least the Foundry by Mozolov at the beginning of this concert and Scriabin's Poem of Ecstasy. But there's much more experimental music to look forward to later on tonight. In just under an hour, we'll be back here for tonight's late night prom given by the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra and pianist John Tilbury. Music from America and England. From America, John Cage and Morton Feldman. And from England, the experimentalist Cornelius Cardew and Howard Skempton, founders and co-runners of the Scratch Orchestra back in the 60s. So more to look forward to from the proms tonight. But meanwhile, for the next hour or less, it's on to Broadcasting House and to Jonathan Swain.
Sarah, thank you, Sarah Moore-Peach there at the Royal Albert Hall, and as well as the BBC iPlayer for listening again via the Radio 3 website, just to say there's another chance to hear tonight's prom broadcast again here on BBC Radio 3 on Thursday afternoon next week. That's the 28th of August at 2:20. Also, if you'd like to submit a review of tonight's prom, then just go to bbc.co.uk/proms and click on share. For example, do you agree with Esa-Pekka Salonen that the Poem of Ecstasy is a piece in bad taste? Does it depend how you conduct it? Possible example of bad taste is a recording of the Poem of Ecstasy from the 1990s conducted by the Russian Dmitry Kitayenko, which adds heavenly voices to that final crescendo. Ah, those Russians. Well, Russian voices now, in fact. Tchaikovsky, writing for the Russian Orthodox tradition. 1878 was the year he completed his Fourth Symphony, the opera Eugene Onegin, the violin concerto, and his setting of the Liturgy of St. John Chrysostom, music that the Imperial Chapel tried to ban, complaining they hadn't been consulted. Luckily, the veto was overturned. The singers here, the Leningrad Glinka Choir, conducted by Vladislav Chernoshenko. the cherubic hymn from Tchaikovsky's Liturgy of St. John Chrysostom. The singers there, Russian ones, the Leningrad Glinka Choir, conducted by Vladislav Chernyushenko. Well, just a mention of this week's Through the Night programmes, if you like, Radio 3's company in the small hours. Most of them this week setting off with nights in Poland. Recent Polish performances of mostly Polish music. Chopin's there in tonight's offerings, his contribution to Liszt's Hexameron variations. And when Chopin's not there, he's very much there in spirit, so to speak. There's a symphony by Chopin's teacher, Elsner, music by the man known as the Chopin of the guitar, and more show-stopping arias by Chopin's contemporary Józef Poniatowski, a great nephew of the Polish king who worked all over the place. One of his trips was accompanying Napoleon III into exile in England. That's all here in Through the Night, here on Radio 3 from 1 o'clock tonight. Do join me for that if you can.
The proms continue on BBC Radio 3. Now, for me, Yannick Nezet-Séguin is one of the most exciting young conductors around, so I'm really looking forward to hearing what he does with the Eroica Symphony. The Rückert Lieder by Mahler includes some of Mahler's most profound songs, and I'm sure Simon Keenly-Seib will have something very personal and special to say about the music. And then there's Wagner's Tannhäuser Overture, which was one of the very first pieces of classical music I ever got to know. And hearing it in a live context, especially at the proms, is always very special. Join me, Rob Cowan, as the proms continue tomorrow at 7:30.
Well, before tonight's second prom, now we've another chance to hear the second part of our series, How Far Will You Go for a Dance? Judith Macrell asks some exceptional dancers how far they push themselves for their art.
And will you be speaking lines?
I hope so. It's something that I really would like to try, especially with him.
Presumably, having done all that breathing as a dancer, you're quite good at
projecting. You will be surprised, but dancers, especially classical dancers, they don't know how to breathe, because everything is tight, everything has to be straight up, and it's more or less you go out of the wing, you know, you stop breathing and you start.
After years of being a critic, I'm still awed by the dedication that dancers bring to their art. To become a great dancer is to embrace a vocation. It takes long and arduous discipline to transform the human body into a performing instrument.
When you change style, you have also to relearn how to breathe.
I'm going to ask dancers about the journey their vocation has taken them on, about the relationships they have with their own bodies and with the choreographers who shape them. As a classical ballerina, Sylvie Guillem has been one of the defining dancers of our age. Her long, hyperflexible body has pushed ballet technique beyond what seemed humanly possible. Those snapshot moments where she stood elegantly poised on one leg, with the other lifted so high it's grazed her ear. The whipping speed of her pirouettes, or the power of her fast, articulate feet. Even at the peak of her ballerina fame, Guillem was voracious in her desire to expand her repertory. Now in her 40s, she's even more so. Determined to continue evolving as a dancer, she's always looking for collaborators with whom to make that journey. One is Russell Malafant, the modern dancer and choreographer. Not only has his fluid, Tai Chi-inspired movement turned Sylvie's classical technique inside out, but as revealed in their recent production Push, to a new score by Andy Cowton, she and Malafant spark an exceptional chemistry on stage. I met Sylvie at Sadler's Wells during a rare free moment. She's currently working with Russell on Honor Garter, a work about the 18th century spy and soldier, the Chevalier d'Eon, who intriguingly spent much of his life and career disguised as a woman. The third collaborator on this project is the Canadian theatre director Robert Lepage. Sylvie first introduced herself to Lepage in Sydney after being entranced by one of his productions.
Before I left, I said, and if by any chance you need a dancer who knows only how to dance, you know, I'm here. So it started like this, une envie, as we say in French, I don't know, an impulse. Yeah, almost to be in contact with someone that has so much talent, because at the end, you can only learn from him. And that's what I wanted to do. I wanted to be for a while, you know, next to this man, work with him, go on stage with him, and experience things that he will teach me, a world he will take me into. And so that was simply that.
Is it as simple as Robert's writing the story, Russell's doing the choreography, and you're dancing, or are you all collaborating together?
No, it's a collaboration. We have a lot of material, you know. We went in a studio, three of us, and we started to improvise. I like this kind of processes of giving what I have and see people do what they can do with it.
When you approach new collaboration, is it a kind of contrary motion with you, that part of you's seeking out the challenge and excited by the challenge, and part of you's thinking, do I want to dive in here?
It seems that it goes against nature. My nature would be to not to have any problem, not to hear about being afraid, not to take any risk, something like this. You know, I imagine myself maybe in a beautiful Zen garden in Japan, just looking at the leaves becoming red in autumn and green in spring. But then I can't help to put myself in situation where it's uncomfortable. It's really uncomfortable to always try things that you never know if you can do it, where people are going to judge you. You know, it's never like the case where everyone is waiting for me with flowers and, okay, you can do what you want, we can, you know, forgive your mistake. No, people are always there to really judge, and in a harsh way. So it's also adding on to the tension. And I always do it. I always do it because at the end I think I like to learn, you know, see as much as I can, feel as much as I can, not to stay in the same place.
Most dancers have to be rootless, following where the work takes them. And for classical dancers, leaving home can begin very early, as young boys and girls embark on the almost religious discipline of their training. Michael Clark is now best known as a choreographer, his style a notorious mix of classical technique and punk rebellion. In productions like I Am Curious Orange, he offered audiences a mix of sublimely beautiful dance, live rock music, avant-garde performance art, and sexually provocative costumes, with maybe a giant dildo attached. Michael began, however, as a novitiate at the Royal Ballet School, where his precocious talent got him a place at the age of 10. Following his gift, he had to leave his home in Aberdeen to come to London.
Sundays were the bleakest days. You kind of, you're putting off that homesickness. Yeah. You miss your family and stuff. Also just the kind of codes of behaviour and what was acceptable and what wasn't was completely different to what I was used to in Scotland. And that applied to in ballet class, you know, like, you know, for example, wearing wide fronts underneath my tights on the first day and wondering why everyone was laughing at me. It sort of intrigued me. I was enjoying trying to fit in and absolutely determined that I was going to be better than anybody else. That isn't a strange thing, but I thought, if I'm going to be this far away from home, you know, I've got to make it worthwhile. The very fortunate thing for me about the time that I was in London was that punk coincided with me, you know, being just about a good enough dancer to get away with being very naughty.
When you decided to, or when you and the Royal Ballet parted company, did you feel any sense of regret or loss that you weren't going to be going down that very pure
There were maybe three or four solos that, I mean, really, there were solos for Dell by Ashton that I would have loved to have done, and that was maybe it. I mean, I love Sleeping Beauty. I love the rigorousness of what I consider to be pure poetry, in a way. Was still something that I longed to do and see. Yeah, there's definitely still, I'm very strongly attracted to perfection. I mean, who isn't? It's a wonderful thing to see. A wonderful thing to be, of course. That would be, you know, yeah, but one can't always be perfect.
Beautiful. The Drano ducks collide, and mercy, gather collide like fancy tension. Powwow.
After Michael left the Royal Ballet School, the modern choreographer, Richard Alston, created a solo for him. Dutiful Ducks was inspired by the almost flawless elegance and line of Michael's dancing, as well as by the mix of rebellion and idealism in his spirit. But Michael felt his own gifts almost as a burden.
Because I couldn't do it in front of other people initially. I was so nervous. It must have been quite painful to watch, like 17-year-old, like, really shaking, and then forgetting the steps and making them up, and it was just... But I guess that's just an indication of how much it mattered to me, what people thought. Was I okay?
Ellen van Schulenburch also left home in order to find herself as a dancer.
I feel I'm still going, and that means that I've gone very far for a dance, starting in the Netherlands, then going to New York, now here. I still feel if I see the opportunity, I will grasp it and I will dance.
Ellen had gone to New York partly to study with the veteran choreographer Merce Cunningham, partly because the city was a mecca for new choreography. Ellen worked as a freelance, experimenting with different styles and forms.
I danced with many companies in New York. My concept was that I was the company and I had this repertoire.
So you were cherry-picking good repertory for yourself by dancing with all these different companies.
And they wanted me. That's nice too, of course.
Ellen was a gift to choreographers, combining her rigorous training with an exceptionally open and adventurous spirit. She performed with some of New York's leading names, including Carol Armitage, Bill T. Jones and Arnie Zane. But then she met the young Michael Clarke, while he too was dancing in the States. He was barely fledged as a choreographer, yet she saw in his ideas something that might reveal the dancer she wanted to be.
Hillary Puritan, Maelstrom, Cook One.
When Michael invited her to London to work on a new duet with him, Ellen gave up her successful American career to join him. The two of them lived hand to mouth, but the duet that resulted became a turning point in both their careers.
New Puritan.
Performed to Hail the New Puritan by the post-punk band The Fall, it had Ellen and Michael dancing fierce neoclassical movement in platform heels and buttock-bearing tights. To those of us in the audience, it felt like a new chapter in modern dance.
I had so much faith. I believed so much in him or in his talent. He was beginning, and I thought, this is so beautiful, and what an exciting, what an honor to be part of the development of that talent, and that I am there. And the ego is not there, really, I think. And it's like a complete sort of falling in love with that work. And it became, in my whole life, much more than it maybe, you know, maybe that is healthy, you know, I don't know. He could depend on me, you know, I would bend backwards to get it right.
Is there anything you wouldn't have done for him?
I think in a private sense, there's certain things that's very hard to do for another person. Mm. But I think as a dancer, I would do everything.
Jonathan Goddard is the first modern dancer ever to have won the Critics Circle Award for Best Male Artist. He is a wonderful performer to watch, stylish, articulate, and uniquely at ease. And in some ways, his approach to his career seems equally relaxed. At the age of 12, he resisted the pressure of going to the Royal Ballet School. As a young man, embarking on his career in modern dance, he was wary of the dazzle of extreme new trends. At the age of 29, he's recently joined Rombert Dance Company. But before that, he was mentored by the mature choreographer, Richard Alston.
I've always sort of liked Richard's work. And when I was small, I used to get the Dancing Times and I'd see these pictures of the, you know, the big sort of backdrops and all the dancers in the unitards. And I always thought, you know, that's you've made it. Once you get to that standard and you look like that, then you've really made it. I think he's very English, which I like. I think his pursuit is for beauty in form, which I also like. A lot of the work that I was doing before with younger choreographers, it was a pursuit for the new and the extreme and pushing things harder so that people hadn't seen things and seeing bodies in a way that you sort of, you know, you look and go, oh, how on earth did they do that, you know. Whereas Richard, I think he gives time for things to evolve, maybe more like a sculptor.
So having made the decision to leave Richard Alston's company for Rombe, which is going back to a repertory company, obviously you're going to get a far wider, greater variety of choreography to dance.
I mean, dance is really pushing all areas. Like, they do almost do gymnastics here in some of the pieces, and I know they've had tumbling sessions, and it is pushing out to all the extremes, but you do get support within that.
So you don't fear that you're more likely to get injured in those more gymnastic, physically raw pieces?
Yes, you're probably more likely to get injured because you're using different muscles. Say with Richard, it's a very specific training and you're sort of using the same sorts of muscles in the same way.
Do dancers resent choreographers when they make them take risks?
Yeah, if I was truthful, yeah. Sometimes just to try and find something new. A lot of work is like that now, so sometimes I don't think it is so new. That's just my opinion. If you're seeing legs up by the ears all the time and people constantly flipping around, it becomes quite normal. Whereas if you only see that once in a piece, it becomes quite shining.
The urge to be new extends to many extremes in dance, pushing not only the limits of the fabulously able-bodied, but also those of the disabled. David Toole fascinates choreographers. With both legs amputated just below the hip, he can only dance using his torso and arms. But what he achieves can be almost disorientingly virtuoso, gliding, spinning, leaping and balancing on his long, strong arms. When working with new choreographers, however, David often feels frustrated that they don't demand enough of him.
There's been situations where people are sort of like too easily impressed. They've just taken one throwaway moment and gone, that's good enough. And it's hard to turn around to a choreographer and go, actually, that's crap. Don't you want anything a little bit more interesting? I don't know whether they were frightened of breaking you or killing you or something because, you know, because you're special. And you just go, oh. That's why I always, you know, kind of worry about why you're employed sometimes. Is it just a trick, novelty, whatever, you know?
One choreographer with whom David has worked very productively is Lloyd Newson, dancing in both the stage and film versions of Newson's award-winning production, The Cost of Living. Newson himself has been a vocal critic of the more old-fashioned traditions that linger within dance culture. But romantic ideals of dedication do still persist among many of his dancers. When David was performing Cost of Living, he was suffering from undiagnosed kidney failure. Yet he didn't even question working through his illness and exhaustion. This is one of the paradoxes inherent in the profession. Dancers are uniquely attuned to their own bodies, yet they also have a dangerous capacity to override their physical instincts for self-preservation, ignoring fatigue and suppressing pain.
When we originally made the show, obviously, when your kidneys are going, you retain fluid, so I was, like, out there, couldn't carry my own weight, I was struggling. I used to go on stage, do bits, and then go off stage. I couldn't breathe. I literally couldn't breathe. I was fighting for breath before I went back on again. The film made in 2003, and it's funny for me to watch it now because I've got this, well, I'm quite chubby on it, got this fat face on it, because I had a kidney transplant the previous November. I'll just fast forward through all this. Do you want to go to the scoot a bit? In the original show, Eddie and me are obviously trying to make a living in this town. And we did this ventriloquist dummy act, so I was his ventriloquist dummy. So our only mode of transport was this scooter that I would sit on the front while Eddie drove. And we filmed it on this hill, which was quite steep. And you can see here, we're going down this hill. I'm hanging on for dear life. got to the bottom, the camera car braked and we weren't ready for it, and Eddie sort of swerved the scooter. We were travelling fair rate of knots, and I thought, oh, I better help him stop, and I put my elbow down to stop, thinking that was a good idea. Lifted my elbow up. He was like, no shirt, and there's blood everywhere, just ripped my elbow up. When I watch this scene now, you can actually see when I'm going down the hill, all my shirt's taped up with gaffer tape. But it's just funny. I can't bear to watch myself. I think there's one thing in this film that I do well. Well, not well. One thing that I can bear to watch.
This self-immolating sense of not being good enough and of constantly having to push the body is one that cuts across all forms of dance. When Michael Clark left the world of ballet to invent his own aesthetic, he made a point of including non-dancers in his work, like the massively built Lee Bowery. But in terms of his own performances, he could never forget the ideals of his training: purity of line, clarity of detail. The voice of his ballet teachers was still in his head.
You know, I know part of that discipline and training is about protecting yourself.
And do you think you got quite bad at protecting yourself?
Oh, God, yeah. I mean, I a couple of times I tore cartilage in my knee and my knees and felt it at the time. I thought, oh, that's interesting. I haven't felt that before. I mean, it was not painful until quite a few days later. I mean, that can even be adrenaline can cause that. You just don't feel things in the same way. I couldn't have really pushed myself any further than I did.
Physically on stage.
Yeah, physically on stage, but also I used to feel like I got so in my own head that I had to get completely out of my head in order to relax. And it, of course, it makes perfect sense if you spend so much time learning to control your body and make it do very extreme things. It makes sense to me that one would need to do the opposite as well and to actually let go completely. I don't know if I still think that, but I certainly in my teens thought that every artist had to. You know, it was their job to go and do these extreme things to themselves, to find out things that other people maybe weren't allowed to and report back.
There's a long tradition of artists who've done that precisely and have viewed their art in that way.
My experience of it was that, you know, what initially was intended as some form of selflessness, really, for your ego not to get in the way of your work. Of course, you know, drugs and alcohol lead to a very self-indulgent mindset and behaviour, which is not useful for an artist. But, I mean, in terms of dance, do people need to get that drunk to dance? I mean, some people I'm sure do. It's I mean, it's fraught with kind of like dangers and fears and, you know, that whole thing of, am I doing the right dance? What does it mean? I mean, I would never dance now in a social situation.
Would you not?
No, oh goodness, no. I mean, I just couldn't, because everyone, I mean, I'd be aware of being watched, unfortunately.
Michael's use of drink and drugs as fuel for self-discovery proved almost fatal to his career. His company began to fall apart, his behaviour was erratic, and he was not producing the kind of work that Ellen Van Schulenburch had crossed the Atlantic for. Having dedicated herself to Michael's choreography for 6 critical years, Ellen forced herself to leave him.
I really gave up everything, but then I can question myself, as you know, next time, is that a good thing? That's a very useful thing, that's a very innocent thing, and that's maybe a very beautiful thing. But Michael's work is my muse, but I have my own muse as well, and that's basically where I dance. And that's then sort of not happening, and it's not, has been taken away, and of course I'm angry, but I'm also really sad, because I wish, and then you start doing the whole thing like you feel guilty and I wish I could have changed things or say, or grab Michael and punch him or say, now you come here and do. So it becomes a very complex drama. It takes forever to actually sort out. And I think Michael and I are still sorting out. We're still best friends and I teach his company. But I also still want to sort of be there and dance, you know, and I always think like, but it's like this, you know, it's like, yeah, you know, it's that, and it's...
But that's a very poignant and particular thing about being a dancer, isn't it? Particularly when you've created certain roles. There's not really another art form where you have that sort of intimate relationship with the material, and to see it then being given to other dancers, you have to be very generous, very philosophical, don't you, to... Yeah. Let that go.
And it would be created on you. It was for you, you know? So you always had this feeling it was also about you, you know?
But it's so much about your body.
Yeah, and I sort of remember sort of once, you know, in Curious Orange, like sort of dancing, and I was very sort of precise and classical in the rhythms. And there's Lee beside me with his big shoes on and clomping away. And it became very clear to me, like, Lee has to be completely Lee and I have to be completely me. And then we can coexist. So in order to be part of that sort of world, I had to be very much Ellen and I had to be a good dancer, you know.
So you were there really to be the pure dance element.
That's what
that everything else was reacting against, all the campy jokes and the mad props and the loud music, and there was Ellen being perfect.
I was surfing the dance.
Being a dancer can be lonely, not only because of the friends and family that have been left behind, but because it's ultimately only themselves and their bodies that dancers can rely on, even in the collaborative process of making new work. Sylvie Guillaume.
You always have at one point this kind of feeling where you feel alone. You know, even when you are improvising, when you are suggesting things, it's really, you feel vulnerable, you feel alone, because there is almost nothing that can support you. And also you are going towards the unknown, rather than for the classical ballet, I was going towards the known, and I was trying to modify what I knew to make it evolve. This one goes into the world of unknown. So there is more vulnerability, as much loneliness, I would say, and a lot of excitement.
All dancers have to be able to adapt to different movement styles. It's part of their extraordinary physical intelligence that they can do so. When Ellen left Michael, she was once again having to search for a choreographer. She was willing to try martial arts and extreme forms of minimalism in order to discover how many styles her own body could inhabit.
I have a feeling it's the same body that sort of finds... I think you go through doors. I enjoyed that so much, and I think for me that's what it really is. It's like, it's the process of doing it, and not because I can do this, I will show you what I can do. It's the process that is actually what makes art, I think. I was in France this summer, and I would collect experiences, like at night looking up and seeing the stars. So and I have all these things in my history to use. And that's what I like about teaching dancers. And here at Laban, especially when I have the second years now, you know, maybe you can help create more artistic dancers, sort of.
So when you teach your dancers, it's not just the technique you're giving them, it's actually about expanding themselves imaginatively.
Yes. This was used to hang in the dressing room, Cunningham Studio. It's like, no two people walk alike. That's where you start. So you have to do it with your body. Anybody can do it. There's no perfect body.
It's very interesting you talk about every dancer being individual, because you know, even within the much more kind of soft focus areas of dance, say, and the opposite end of ballet, which is deeply competitive and deeply, you know, rooted in a kind of ideal, there is still that double pressure between trying to be the best and, as you say, having that confidence, say, I am this particular body. For a profession that... where people are very young and they enter it very young, that's quite a difficult thing to take
but
on board, isn't it?
But I think it will save their bodies. If I would have tried to do an arabesque like Makarova's when I was young, which I don't have, I would have ruined my whole structure. So it is this body that I have, and it's not a bad body. I've got great feet. I've got immediately good lines. So that's how you sum things up. But I don't want to do something that I cannot, that's not within me. That's why I always sort of speak like you do your leg to the back. Don't do an arabesque, because then they have a picture of an arabesque, and I don't want that picture. We don't need the picture of the arabesque which you saw when you were really young in a magazine. And if you can't jump, then you just practice more. If you're always too slow when it's fast, practice moving your feet. But if you can do that kind of from the beginning, and that failing is part of the process, you know, next time you feel better and better and better.
Merce Cunningham is a choreographer who is fascinated by the differences between his dancers' minds and bodies. But he's also one who inspires an almost selfless veneration. Some dancers do happily devote their careers to just one choreographer, like Robert Swinston, who's been a Cunningham dancer now for 28 years. I met him at the Barbican in London where the company were performing, and he described what it is that keeps a dancer like him enthralled.
What it is, and I say this is a philosophy of Merce, is that in every class he tries to give something that is impossible to do. And I think he does that with a sense of glee, almost. I mean, he has a sense of humor, and he loves to watch us, you know, thrash around. So that there is never any moment where you can really sort of think, well, you've got it. It's never there. And, you know, part of the training is developing willpower. Merce is an expert at that because of how he paces the class. The slow movements are glacially slow. The fast movements are, you know, like a laser.
Moving between many different choreographers, Sylvie Guillaume has found new philosophies as well as new ways of dancing. She created the duet Sacred Monsters with a Katak-trained dancer and choreographer, Akram Khan. And during this production, she also worked with guest choreographer Lin Huai Min from Taiwan.
In the case of Lin Huai Min, physically it was hard for me because everything is slow and super slow. And my muscles, in fact, the way I'm built, the muscles are quite long, the ligament also. It's not something as the strength for slow motion things. So it was painful. It was painful to work in the morning with Lin Huai Min, slow motion, and to work in the afternoon with Akram in a speed that you can't imagine. You know? So it was the contrast also that was difficult. But what I learned a lot with Lin Huai Min is that I could do with a bit more patience toward myself, because I am so much in a hurry to do things and to do things right that I get angry, I get tense. So he was helping me to calm down and see it differently and say, well, give you the chance to do this. Don't be angry, don't be... So it's a way of saying things. It's a way I like.
I was going to ask, I mean, do you feel time as a pressure? Because you feel there is so much out there to learn. Are you feeling you're having to pace yourself in order to protect your body that you can do all this stuff, or are you just still eager to grab it all?
Well, it's a little bit of both. You know that as much as I can, you know, grab things, I will. And I know also that I have to be careful to be able to. But, well, I know that time is running with everything that goes with it. So I guess, you know, slowly I start to accept it. You know, sometimes you can associate this kind of thing as a bulimia of life, as you say. You want to grab things as much as you can because you're afraid not to be able to. But no, it's, in a way, yes and no. Life is here. You don't know if you will be here tomorrow, so you do it. You know? And I refuse to say, okay, tomorrow I have time, or in another time I will have time. No, I won't have time. So it's now. It's just passing in front of me now. I take it now. But I will do it in a, I try to be serious about it and not just to burn it like this, if you want. So it's a little bit of both. It's reason and unreason, you know.
Does time stop for you when you're dancing? I mean, when you're actually on stage?
It depends. Sometimes it's not that the time stops, the time becomes different, it expands. Sometimes it's a bit of a kind of a slow motion bit. Sometimes it's going too fast. Sometimes you are in control. Sometimes the stage is in control or the atmosphere is in control and you just follow it. You know, you have your instinct that basically save it or maybe run after it, I don't know. And that's why it's so exciting, because you never know how it will be. Sometimes it's really scary.
Many dancers feel most themselves when they're performing on stage. So when age or injury forces them to retire, it can be painful to consider not only what they will do, but who they will become.
Dancing is a young person's art. That's for sure. Now, a lot of dancers just don't go much beyond 40. Whether for a number of reasons. You know, in some companies like the Paris Opera, they force you to retire. I think women at 40, men at 45. But we've worked with Misha Baryshnikov, and he's actually older than I am, but he's still dancing. Now, you find things that you can do, and I mean, Merce did. He created for himself. He created parts that he could accomplish. Not everybody's that fortunate to be a great choreographer and a great dancer as well. So you don't see this too often. I think it's kind of an anomaly that I should continue to dance so long. So I ask constantly, I mean, and this is, I'm not just doing it to get a positive response from people, but I do ask people if it's time. But I do wonder why a person in their late 50s is still walking around in unitard. It's something within me that movement is necessary for me. And that's, I think, that word is probably the key to the whole thing. So I think that's the word that sort of guided me. Now, of course, I'm compulsive. I'm a compulsive dancer as well, like a lot of dancers are. They must do it, and if they're not doing it, they feel like they're missing something.
There was nothing I wouldn't do to be better at what I wanted to be good at. And it's kind of shocking and ridiculous and outrageous, really.
And do you still do class now?
No. I mean, I do something every day. I haven't done class for ages. And I've got to the point where I don't really want other people telling me what to do. But I'm sure I'll go back to it.
And do you think about the things you've given up for this obsession?
Well, hobbies. I have a brother and sisters who have families, and that looks, and I love seeing them, and they have a great life, but it's not what I have, and it's different what I have, but I like it very much too.
I'm very happy with it. It's fine, even though it's like I don't own a house, I don't own anything.
Dance asks you to make huge sacrifices with your time, because you're always away on tour. You're always physically tired. Not mentally tired, but when I come home, I'm always sort of physically tired, which can make you quite grumpy. And also financially, it's not, you know, I couldn't raise a family on this kind of wage. So that those things you sort of have to give up or find a way around, I suppose. Yeah, it's difficult. You really have to sacrifice for dance.
Having made those sacrifices, do you ever think, well, give yourself maybe just a few more years and then find a way back into what counts for normal life?
Yeah, I mean, I really love what I do.
Well done, John.
I sort of wonder, I suppose with the recognition slightly made me wonder if there is another way, whether it always has to be within companies and whether audiences would just come and watch a dancer. I suppose that's a question that I can't really answer yet. I had some friends and they did a project called Probe, and they were sort of trying to push that just slightly, so the dancers commissioned the work rather than the other way around. And I suppose that's something that could be explored.
The title of the programme is How Far Will You Go for a Dance? And it is partly a bit about what people feel, how far they've pushed themselves or what they've given up. Do you think about what you've given up?
I'm not into regretting or having remorse of having done that instead of this and that. On the contrary, I mean, I am really, really lucky. You know, by chance, I did something fantastic that bring me, you know, fun, love, friendship, extraordinary moment, you know, beauty. I saw a lot of that. I experienced a lot of that. I met a lot of, you know, talented people, and I've seen a lot of beauty. I love to doing it. I had a lot of fun on stage. I really do.
Yeah, because I know a lot of the time you've talked about this little kind of stone of fear and shyness and vulnerability that's in the core of you, and that, in a way, that seems to be where your creativity comes from.
I think it does. You have always your secret place. But strangely enough, I think you can be like this. I can be like this in everyday life. And on stage, I'm not like this at all. You know, the box or the secret place doesn't exist. Everything is there and really with the light on it. So I can't hide anything. I think it's one of the great power of stage. It's liberating.
So in a way, I mean, you've talked a lot about having originally been a gymnast and very physical in that way. But do you think that actually it was your career as a dancer that gave you the kind of liberation that being a gymnast wouldn't?
No. I had a lot of fun in gymnastics, much more than at the ballet school. Much more. It was much more free. It was more creative also, because I was doing my own choreography. But it was becoming too dangerous for me at that time. The really best part for me in gymnastics was the square on the floor. For me, it was a firework. Each time I was going there, I think, because it's the memory I have of it, to be the most happy kid in the world. You know, I had those few minutes with the music I had chosen, the choreography I had chosen, and the kind of, acrobacy I could do. And it was really my moment. I don't know if it was true, but it's the image, you know, I have of me. And then I arrived at the Paris Opera School, and it was so tough, do this, not that, not like this, not like that, and this, it's called this, it's called that. We had, you know, not learned those kind of things. We didn't know that it had to be so strict. So I didn't really like this part of it, but the stage... Suddenly I had seen the connection between the floor, you know, when I was a gymnast, this kind of moment where people could see, hear the music and suddenly concentrated on what you were doing, and the stage. People were there, you were alone on stage, you knew that the light was here more or less for you, and that was it, the connection was done, you know. So I forgot about everything that was negative, like some of the teacher were a pain, some rules were a little bit, bon. I forgot all of that because I knew that stage was something, and that the liberté, the freedom, and the excitement, I would get it from that.
Do you think that'll keep you performing for many more years?
Many more years, I don't know. I don't think so, but for a few years, yes, and as long as I bring pleasure and I get pleasure, I will.
Merce Cunningham once wrote that dancing is not for unsteady souls. It gives you nothing back but that single, fleeting moment of being alive. That moment, when a dancer's mind and body are fused into something powerful and beautiful, is the ultimate reward of the profession. But that moment is also predicated on failure. A lot of what dancers aspire to is impossible, stopping time, defying gravity. And great dancing moves us, not only because it seems to transcend human limitations, but also because it involves a constant struggle with them.
Why do people feel the need to create this perfect world? You know, Well, obviously, it's kind of obvious, isn't it? Because the world isn't perfect. But that seems a bit too obvious to me, do you know what I mean? But then again, you're guaranteed something will go wrong anyway. Do you know what I mean? People are human. I'm definitely still very strongly attracted to perfection. The pleasure in seeing something perfectly executed is a wonderful thing to experience, isn't it? I mean, what more can you ask for?
And also, it was terribly disconcerting for my family, and I think it still is, the way I live my life. And maybe they're right, but I have something that lives within me, and I can be Ellen, basically, and that's sort of... So I feel like I'm not having been interfered with, so I can be... the purest, purest is a bit of a strange word, but I can sort of, I don't need any extra attire.
How Far Will You Go for a Dance was produced by Francis Burns. The presenter was Judith McCrell, and it was a Loftus production for BBC Radio 3, first broadcast in December 2008.
Vladimir Ashkenazi conducts the Sydney Symphony in the BBC Proms on Tuesday, bringing to life the lushly romantic waltzes of Richard Strauss's Der Rosenkavalier. That's followed by Scriabin's Third Symphony, portraying the dance between the human spirit and the cosmos. And there are jazz rhythms to finish as Hélène Grimaud plays Ravel's G major piano concerto. The Sydney Symphony at the BBC Proms this Tuesday evening at 7:30 here on BBC Radio 3.
BBC Radio 3, it's now 10 o'clock. Well, coming up at 11:30 tonight, Lopo Cattari introduces World on 3. But now from the stage of the Royal Albert Hall in London, here's Martin Handley with the second of this evening's proms.
Good evening and welcome to the Royal Albert Hall from me, Martin Handley, to this late night BBC Prom live on Radio 3, a continuation of the Prom celebration of the 75th anniversary of the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra. Its principal guest conductor, Ilan Volkov, will be on the podium for a programme of experimental work by composers from both sides of the Atlantic, to whom the word music meant and means something pretty all-embracing. Experimental doesn't necessarily mean new, but three of our four pieces are only now receiving their London or Proms premieres. For instance, Morton Feldman's dreamlike painterly piano and orchestra, which ends the programme, is 35 years old. It couldn't have a better advocate than its soloist tonight, John Tilbury. Feldman had an important role in the development of Howard Skempton's musical language, and it's his majestically radiant rapt lento which precedes the Feldman. That's going to be quite some contrast after the complexities of Skempton's teacher Cornelius Cardew's Bun No. 1 for orchestra, an incredibly sophisticated kaleidoscope of a piece for large orchestra, but without any percussion, which is where our first piece comes in. It's the oldest of the lot, written in 1939 by a man who would later be a big influence on Cardew, John Cage, and it's all percussion, some 58 instruments, and all metallic, as its title indicates. First construction in metal for percussion sextet. There's quite some array on the stage behind me, set up in what look like five thundersheet-equipped percussion workstations. Bells of all kinds, anvils, car brake drums, and various gongs, including one to be lowered into a tub of water to produce a great glissando effect. Each player can produce at least 16 sounds, and the number 16 is central to everything about this piece. In the end, though, it's a glorious cornucopia of sounds, which seems to range from the Balinese gamelan to the factory floor, and feels as infectiously exciting now as it must have done 71 years ago when it was written. Well, the musicians from the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra are ready and waiting. So now please welcome to the stage Ilan Volkov to conduct John Cage's first construction in metal for percussion sextet. Thank you. John Cage's first Construction in Metal for Percussion Sextet performed to open this late-night BBC prom live on Radio 3 by a percussionist of the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra conducted by Ilan Volkov. Heather Corbett, Dave Lyons, Martin Willis, Ian Coulter, Stuart Semple and Linda Cochran, the pianist, you might say, plus her glamorous assistant, Robert Peirce, who was manipulating the metal bars across the strings of the piano. It's written at the end of the 30s, as I was saying, the first significant work for percussion alone, perhaps Varese's Ionization at the beginning of that decade, then Henry Cowell's Ostinato Pianissimo, and then The Cage. Wonderful visual treat. Ah, Ilan Volkov comes bounding onto the platform, dragging six percussionists and assistant together to the front of the stage. Glistening, glittering thunder sheets, performers with their backs to them, the musicians, beating all hell out of them at some moments. And the water gong. A slightly understated white plastic bucket, but the sound was fantastic. Well, I'm joined in the Radio 3 box by composer and Here and Now presenter Robert Warby. Thanks for being part of this rather magnificent evening, Robert.
Pleasure, pleasure.
John Cage, the most influential American composer of the last century?
I think that's probably fair, isn't it? An astonishing career, amazing ideas, not only a composer, a visual artist, exactly. A poet, a writer, all of those things.
Yes, kind of Renaissance man.
Absolutely.
Well, 1972 was a good year at the BBC proms for Cage. This piece was played in a main prom conducted by Boulez. Then at a late night gig at the Roundhouse, there was his work Harpsichord, involving seven harpsichordists, among them John Tilbury, who we'll hear later on playing Morton Feldman, and Cornelius Cardew, whose Bun Number One for Orchestra is our next music. Written for large orchestra without percussion, so you can imagine there's quite a lot to be cleared up and moved on stage first. Robert, this is the first time any Cardew's been heard at the proms since The Great Learning, Paragraph 1, was performed in 1972. And that was something of a notorious event.
I think it was, yeah. It's very interesting that the composer Howard Skempton, performer John Tilbury, they were in the Scratch Orchestra.
Exactly.
On this very stage in 1972. I think there was a bit of a fuss because Cornelius Cardew and the Scratch Orchestra wanted Maoist banners hanging probably from the ceiling. And yes. And on those banners, one of the banners was to be written, "A revolution is not a dinner party. A revolution is an insurrection, an act of violence by which one class overthrows another." Mao Zedong wrote that in 1927. I can't imagine what kind of threat it posed in 1972.
No, and I don't quite know. John Tilbury was saying earlier there was some sort of compromise reached, which actually nobody liked. Typical British compromise.
Probably not a compromise at all.
No.
Yes, exactly. That was the last time any music by Cornelius Cardew was performed, 1972, here at the proms. The Scratch Orchestra then went on that year to Munich, to the Olympic Games, where there was a debacle over a performance of Christian Wolff's Burdocks, and John Cage, who we've just heard, and Morton Feldman, who we're going to hear later, along with David Tudor, attacked the Scratch Orchestra for their performance of this piece. So maybe not a happy year for the Scratch Orchestra in 1972.
Well, let's hope it's a bit of a happier year in 2010 with Cardew's Bun Number One. It's actually a student piece written in the mid-60s while he was studying with Gottfredo Petrassi in Rome. And I asked tonight's Feldman soloist and Cardew's biographer, John Tilbury, what Cornelius had worked on with Petrassi.
They studied scores, classical scores, orchestration scores and so forth, and then he had a brief to write an orchestral piece, which clearly Petrassi oversaw, and it was done in Rome, and then I know it was done in Palermo. He learnt about how to treat the orchestra, he learnt how to orchestrate.
And you certainly hear that in the piece.
You do, yes.
I mean, it's a tour de force, really.
It is. I think it's a remarkable piece, and it's quite muscular, isn't it? It's almost a Varesean somehow. It's got that kind of abrasiveness. And yet at the same time, there's wonderful shimmering delicacies in certain parts with the strings and so forth. It's always something happening. Never a dull moment. these sort of wonderful musical images jumping out of the orchestra at the listener. Actually, it reminds me of reading Dickens. You get those wonderful characterizations in Dickens, they jump off the page at you. And the same thing with the Queen's musical images, they really jump out at you. And it's an exciting score. I'm so pleased that it's done. And that, I mean, there are, I think, 5 orchestra pieces. And let's hope that some of them will be done.
Yes, John Tilbury, let's hope Cardew's next prom isn't in another 38 years, but a lot before that. Well, Bun is actually a reworking of an even earlier piece, the 3rd orchestral piece. John Tilbury suggests so Cardew could satisfy academic demands while staying detached, but not precluding a mild curiosity. What do you think that's all about, Robert?
Well, actually, at the time that Cardew produced this piece, he was working on treatises. Mm. We're calling it a student piece, but he was already a well-established composer.
He was, yeah. Absolutely.
I mean, he was at the Royal Academy in the end of the 1950s. 50s, yeah. So he was already knew what he was doing compositionally. And treatises, of course, is this massive graphic score. Mm. I can't remember how many pages, more than 100 pages of graphics. And Cardew had trained to be a typographer, I think, and a graphic designer as a way of earning money,
yeah.
In the 60s. So I think he thought of this piece, Bun Number 1, as a kind of orchestration of treaties. These were the things he had on his mind when he went on the course to Italy.
It reminds me of all sorts of things, that Bun Number 1, but it's a kind of, to me, there's a kind of Webern-like quality about it, this sort of pointillistic style.
Indeed, and actually I'm reminded of Xenakis because yes. all the instrumentalists are actually soloists. The strings yes. are divided, we hear glissandi, we hear all kinds of techniques that Xenakis used. So I'm sure Cardew had all of these things in his head.
It's almost as though he had a whole list of things I must use in this piece.
I must do this, tick, 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 exactly. But I think he went to Italy, to get a grip on the orchestra or to get a firm hand on the orchestra. I think he needed to know what the orchestra was and how to use it. And I think the piece is extremely successful.
I mean, it is a kaleidoscope of orchestral sounds and patterns, and some of it is very lyrical, and there's, for me, a very Ivesian solo trumpet which keeps coming through.
And no percussion.
And no percussion.
The way he's got all these different sound worlds without percussion. Astonishing. Great instrumentation, great use of colour. Obviously, it has a very, very fine ear.
Yes, and I mean, it does... You kind of need to say there's no percussion because they're very percussive effects on all sorts of instruments.
Indeed, and as you say about the sort of Varese idea, you get these great sort of blocks of sound and shifting patterns and things. Very solid.
As you were saying, you mentioned Treatise at the time, which of course owed a lot to Cage, didn't it? I mean, that was...
Yes. Cardew, of course, worked with Stockhausen in the early days, and then Cage turned up at Darmstadt with David Tudor, and that put the kibosh on surrealism, I think. Certainly for Cardew, this idea of relinquishing control of the sounds.
Yes.
I think by the time Cardew had written his 3rd piano sonata, he'd moved away from all that... all those serial ideas he got from Stockhausen. So Cage, very, very important composer, very important influence on Cardew. But of course, later when it became politicised, he wrote the famous essay Stockhausen Serves Imperialism, which I think was actually a broadcast to start with, and then he wrote it as a text. And then there's a text or a broadcast called Cage, Ghost or Monster. So he kind of turned on these people who'd had a great influence on him. I think he said about Stockhausen that it was almost like killing his father. You know, he had to kill, to really rid himself of Stockhausen's influence. He had to go to that to those extremes.
I mean, how extreme can you get?
Yeah.
Well, we should perhaps just talk a bit about the title. Cardew apparently told John Tilbury that there were various explanations for the title. The first was, you give an elephant at the zoo a bun, and that's what Cardew himself felt when he gave the piece to an orchestra to play.
Throw
the orchestra a bun. And you can understand that. It's certainly... It's an iced bun, isn't it? With lots of stuff on it. And we're just looking at the stage, which is rapidly filling up now. The second idea was that the piece itself is like a bun, filling but not substantial. And Callum MacDonald in the programme note tonight suggests a third idea, the bun as satisfyingly rounded form and that the piece is like that too. Do you buy into that?
Echoes of Satie, the idea of...
exactly, edible titles.
Edible titles, three pieces in the shape of a pear.
Yeah, I think, I mean, that's. But do you think that the piece has a rounded shape? Do you see that in it, as MacDonald says?
Yes, I can go with that. But I don't see the influence of Satie. I think it's
No. I think that's just the edible title bit.
Indeed, yes.
It seems almost odd now because we have on the stage just being tuned by the guest leader Janice Graham. What looks like a perfectly normal symphony orchestra in many ways, in normal positions, except, as Robert said, there is an ominous gap where the percussionist should be.
No percussion.
Well, now here is Ilan Volkov to conduct the London premiere of Cornelius Cardew's Bun Number One for Orchestra.
Thank you.
Yes, really a kaleidoscope of sounds and patterns in Cornelius Cardew's Bun No. 1 for Orchestra, written in the mid-60s, receiving its London premiere tonight at the BBC Proms, performed by the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra, guest leader Janice Graham, conducted by Ilan Volkov. It's wonderful to see the commitment of the BBC SSO to this kind of work visible in that performance. And if you were listening last night, you'll have heard cellist Anthony Sayer, who's 41 years a member of the orchestra, saying they really enjoy this sort of programme. They know they do it well, and that Ilan Volkov is the ideal conductor. He put together the programme. He's back on the platform, brought the orchestra to its feet, acknowledging the applause from the audience here in the Royal Albert Hall. Well, Cardew, a very charismatic figure whose ideas and teaching influence many in the next generation of composers, both in Britain and the USA and Europe. One of them was Howard Skempton. Skempton also a co-founder with Cornelius Cardew of the Scratch Orchestra in the late 1960s. But when Cardew went off to follow a very political road, Skempton stayed on the experimental side of the line. And if the Cardew piece we've just heard was full of complexities, then Skempton's Lento turns in the opposite musical direction. It was only his third work for full orchestra, and he wrote it to a BBC commission for a piece that would fit into a concert after the prelude to Wagner's Parsifal, and it was followed at that concert in March 1991 by Mahler's 10th Symphony. Skempton uses the same orchestral forces as the Wagner, maintained a similar hushed mood, mostly with strings alone. Trombones and bassoons appear in the heart of the work, but the full orchestra only plays for a tiny proportion of the time. Robert Warby is with me in the Radio 3 box. Robert, how would you describe what Skempton's doing in Lento?
Well, you have to remember that experimental composers are extremely pragmatic, and although this has a very sumptuous, almost gorgeous surface, there are experimental forces at work underneath. I remember when the piece was first composed in the early 90s, I asked him how he'd composed it. And he said it was like, it's like doing a painting. He said, you get your materials on the canvas and you move them around the canvas. And I said, well, how do you know when to stop? And he said, when you reach the edge of the canvas. So it's extremely pragmatic.
It is like that. And the end is just,
it's just like
is
that.
It's just like that. Yes, absolutely. This piece has also been hailed as the emancipation of the consonants, after Schoenberg's remarked about striving for the emancipation of the dissonance. You'll see exactly what that means in just one moment, as here once again comes Ilan Volkov to conduct the BBC Scottish Symphony Orchestra in the first performance at the Proms of Howard Skempton's Lento.